I'm going to go through very briefly Meyerhoff. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because it's not really much to spend time on. He summarized, or Frank Visser summarized, Meyerhoff's criticisms. Frank says, when I asked Meyerhoff to summarize the strongest points of criticism, he came up with the following 6 points. I'll read them very briefly. Sean, you on?
Yes, I am.
Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Okay. The 6 criticisms are minority positions, not orienting generalizations. Wilbur claims to base himself on already accepted knowledge. It's contradicted by the fact that sometimes this knowledge is controversial. Chaos theory, Sheldrake, or represents a minority field in academic field, applying developmental concepts, for example. If you've read this in detail, you'll see that basically this is, Meyerhoff's thing is basically a hatchet job. So he picks just a series of, the sort of negatives and strings them together. Nothing is more apparent in this than he claims that my basic methodology is orienting generalizations. The basic methodology is integral methodological pluralism with at least 8 fundamental methodologies. And to say that it's that my basic methodologies is orienting generalizations is kind of screwy. And, of course, my fundamental claim, which is a legitimate claim and can be argued, is that his fundamental cognitive altitude is green.
Yeah.
And if you analyze the statements that he's making and the solutions that he offers, they reach basically a systemic and metasystemic level on Commons and Richards, and not paradigmatic and cross-paradigmatic. I see very, very little evidence of teal or turquoise cognition. Now, of course, that he would freak at that and claim that that's exactly what's wrong. But if developmental studies have any truth to them at all, this is a legitimate criticism. And so it's the major criticism I enter of his position. And I think I can make it stick pretty straightforwardly. And what you see him doing all the time is stuck in performative contradictions at almost every point he raises, and then struggling to get up into an altitude that would allow him to make the conclusions he wants to, but he can't, so he falls back into performative contradictions. He makes orienting generalizations himself, left and right. To say that I depend on chaos theory and Sheldrake, of course, is nonsense. It's ridiculous. And then I present a minority position with an academic field, developmental concepts to all fields of psychology. I don't apply developmental concepts to all fields of psychology. I apply it to developmental psychology. And if you watch him criticize developmental psychology, it's just hysterical, because the way Green operates, Green hates stages or hierarchies. And so it's very suspicious of development. And it uses a couple of really standard metasystemic attacks on developmental psychology, but it can't get up to cross-paradigmatic orientations. So it'll say things like, it'll take 2 or 3 developmental models and show that they can't agree on the stages. And of course, all developmental stages are different from each other because they're different perspectives. But he won't give an alternative and say, this is what development is really like. So to actually listen to him, it sounds like there's no development at all. So apparently, acorns get to oaks without growing. And that's kind of just left in the air. So you can take any developmental models, line them up with each other, and show that they contradict each other in certain ways. I don't need, let's put it this way. Any developmental model that Meyerhoff wants to offer and assert that it is a good model, I'll take it, because that will give me altitude, and that's all I need. But he won't do that. So, let's just toss that one out. Next, perspectival, not aperspectival. Incidentally, of course, there's legitimate disagreements within the field, and I don't think I've ever glossed over those. What we are indeed looking at when we line all the developmental models up and say, look, something is interesting. There's an increasing something here. And most developmentalists would agree that there's an increase in degrees of complexity. Not every stage is more complex. There are regressions and loops and lateralizations and all of that. But I don't know any developmentalists that don't think development's going someplace and that you can characterize it. And I'll take any characterization he wants. That'll give me altitude. But he won't do it, not in any way that doesn't violate his own tenets. Number two, perspectival, not aperspectival. Wilbur's account of the history of everything has a bias towards evolution, growth, and telos. Well, my account of evolution has a bias towards evolution. That's what we're talking about. What about accounts lacking these ingredients, such as Daniel Dennett? Well, Daniel Dennett's a reductionist. Of course he lacks those ingredients. He's not a hyper-reductionist. Why don't you throw in any of the other great reductionists? We don't take reductionists. That's true. We try to take the true aspects from theorists. Reductionism is not one. There is, of course, in the environment of Green, again, this large attempt to say that there is no development in terms of anything getting, quote, higher, better, deeper, wider. And so, you know, worms are, you know, equal to people. As the human beings have no, there's nothing about humans that are better than worms. And I know many humans of which that's true. But in this case, there are ways in which you can speak of evolution being, again, following some sort of gradient. It doesn't have to be a metaphysical telos. I don't believe in a metaphysical telos. I'll get to that in a minute. I think one of the really good accounts of how Mike Murphy summarized a lot of the good accounts of the things about evolution that can be said to be higher, and there's an awful lot of them, and in The Future of the Body, the first third of the book, he goes through many, many, many of them. None of which, of course, are mentioned by Marha, because hatchet jobs don't weigh evidence. They just try to give one negative after another. I don't know of any more mainstream and respected theorist of evolution than Ernst Mayr. And I'll just read one very simple quote and just have done with it. Is evolution progressive? He says, our phylogenetically later organisms higher than their ancestors. Yes, they're higher on the phylogenetic tree. Then he goes in to talk about a paragraph or two saying that it is very difficult to say what's better or what's higher and so on. And so he gives both sides of that, but he concludes very simply, what cannot be denied, however, is that in every generation, the evolutionary process, a surviving individual is on the average better adapted than the average of the non-survivors. To that extent, evolution clearly is progressive. End of that topic. Another one that I think I'll briefly mention, that book, incidentally, by Ernest Mayr is called What Evolution Is, forwarded by Jared Diamond. There's one of the books I want to talk about is The Triple Helix by Richard Lewontin. And a professor at Harvard and, again, one of the most highly respected and beloved, you might say, theorists of biology and evolution in particular. And this is a very recent book, so it summarizes the recent data. What he's done in this book basically is what any really sensitive biologist does when they're kind of, you know, drop the neo-Darwinian party line and really look at evolution. And there's a lot that natural selection explains. What it doesn't explain is the origin of variation itself. And it's just anybody that looks at that says, okay, that's it. The story's over. They can't account for that. It does not mean intelligent design, and it does not mean platonic telos. I don't believe in any of those. And Meyerhoff is just way out of date when he even mentions otherwise. So, again, it's just a useless criticism in this particular regard. I want to read you, though, a section from Lewontin's book on the triple helix, because that one section in A Brief History of Everything, where I was just sort of throwing out examples, not really meant to be scientific examples, but just sort of colloquial examples to show what's involved. And I always talk about development of a wing, for example, or an eyeball, because in order to develop a wing, you know, you really do have to have several mutations, not just one. And not only do you have to have several that are selected in one animal, let's say you have to have four mutations, which is just astronomically impossible. That has to happen in the male, and then you have to have the same four happen in the female someplace else, and they have to find each other. And it's like, I can just see the want ads going up on on that one. Mutation on gene 388-499-728, looking for partner. And Visser has made a big deal about how everybody, all the scientists jumped on that and said, Wilbur doesn't know what he's talking about. Oh, well, dear me. Let me read from Lewontin. He's talking about, you know, what natural selection does account for. He says, the uncertainty of selective outcome arises from an even more elementary process, the origin of variation itself. And again, where does the original, higher, complex organ come from? Where does this extraordinary transformation come from? He continues, genetic variation depends on the process of mutation, and mutations are very rare events. Any particular new DNA mutation will occur only once in about 100 million gametes. Moreover, when a single mutation occurs in a single newborn, even if it is a favorable mutation, there's a fair probability that it will not be represented in the next generation because its single carrier may not by chance pass it on to its few offspring. The time between the origin of a species and the time that a mutation of just the right sort occurs and reaches a high enough frequency to be significant in the selective process is one of the same order as the total lifetime of the species, around 10 million years. So most mutations that would have selected if they had occurred are never seen. Moreover, the mutations that can occur in a species are conditioned by its current genetic state. Each mutation is a single substitution in DNA. To produce a selectively useful genetic variant from the current DNA sequence may require not one mutation, but several, as I said, each of exactly the correct sort. Given that vertebrates are four-limbed animals, it might take many mutations, though one of them useful in itself, to reach a genetic variant that could be the basis for adding wings while keeping legs. Selection may call, but there may be no mutations to answer. And that's just what I said. So I happen to be in accord with the most recent mainstream thought in biological evolution. End of that one. I could go into any of the details in this. It'd be the same. I'm just going to go over the large, broad criticisms in the same brief way. Let me mention that the telos, all we're talking about in telos is not a pre-given end. That just has nothing to do with it. What I've made really clear, and particularly in the post-metaphysical writings, is that what we see in the universe is just a capacity to self-organization. And I've often quoted Eric Jantz's phrase, which I really love from the self-organizing universe, that evolution is self-organization through self-transcendence. And I think that summarizes it all. There is a self-transcending drive, and I've called that Eros, not in a metaphysical sense, but just to connect it with the intuitive assertion, going all the way back to Plato and before, that there is an Eros to the cosmos. Now, they had a different interpretation that was metaphysical. Mine has never been metaphysical. I've always used it, though, to say that this self-transcending drive is, of course, part of spirit's own unfolding. And I believe that that unfolding is creative at the leading edge. And that's why it can be laid down in any number of ways that are not predetermined at all. But once they're laid down, they become cosmic habits. And that's, frankly, I think, a brilliant way to handle it, because it lets evolution be non-Platonic, non-predetermined, non-teleonomic, and yet accounts for the fact that, you know, up to, let's say, orange or green, the stages in humans going from magenta to red to amber to orange are, in a sense, given now. But not platonically, but by history. And incidentally, many instances on that. He starts in particular, he's onto the notion of holons. He's basically, the book is about, to put it this way, I'll quote again, the functional approach to the definition of parts clarifies the actual process of definition. To be parts, things must be part of something. That is, there are no parts unless there is a whole of which there are pieces. And so he goes on to define several wholes, and he's basically talking about holons. Then he talks about there's a hierarchy and there's heterarchy, and there's selection at each of those levels. And that's a very important point. If you actually get out of the notion of natural selection operating merely on DNA sequences, which really just doesn't work. So I gave a quote, several quotes in footnotes to SES, showing that if you quote Stephen Jay Gould all the way over to Francisco Varela, what really amounts to is any holon at any level of the hierarchy is a selection unit. And even Stephen Jay Gould says that. And I don't know how to get any more mainstream than that. And so this is right down the middle of the road. And what all we try to do is take these really fundamental, widely accepted orientations and put them together. Something Green can't do. So, of course, Meyerhoff's going to have a very hard time following that part of the argument. And he falls into performative contradictions at that point. And then he gets very, very mad, projects his own shadow, and writes chapter 12.
Yeah, that thing out of control.
Huh?
That chapter is totally out of control.
Yeah, and it's just his shadow. It's just straightforward, a reading of his own shadow. As Oscar Wilde said, criticism is the highest form of autobiography. I would say the lowest form in many cases, but it's clearly his own shadow, and it's clearly on parade. But Lewontin, he was a favorite of Francisco Varela's, and I think a favorite of anybody who's really, he's really looking hard at the upper right and lower right quadrants. And the conclusion he reaches, which we of course agree with, and this is, remember, we're not making the claim that organisms, you know, and environment mutually in tetra interact. We're making the claim that they bring them forth, that there's an actual constructivist, co-creative component, which is a strong version. It's the strong part of the truth from the postmodernist claim. But we believe it not for postmodern reasons, but because the leading edge of evolution is bringing forth new creative moments through its own eros. It's self-organization through self-transcendence. And self-transcendence means that new worlds are being enacted, being created. So here's Lewontin's conclusion right out of mainstream Harvard. The central message is that we will never fully understand living things if we continue to think of genes, organisms, and environments as separate entities, each with its distinct role to play in the history and operation of organic processes. An organism, rather, is a unique consequence of both genes and environment, of both internal and external features. Rejecting the notion that genes determine the organism, which then adapts to the environment, he explains that organisms, influenced in their development by their circumstances, in turn create, modify, and choose the environment in which they live. Create, modify, and choose. In other words, they enact the environment and bring it forth. Now, of course, when he says internal and external, what does he mean? Upper right and lower right.
Yeah.
And then also, he is trying to work with, in the sense that he's the agency on the organism, so he's very much, in a sense, in the autopoetic stream, although he doesn't really base it on that, it's very compatible with that. He's working Zone 7 and how Zone 7 brings forth is part of the enacting and bringing forth of the actual environments in the lower right. These things tetra enact each other. And that's extremely important, and we've got large amounts of really good mainstream stuff backing this. If you can see turquoise. If you can't, then of course all you can do is see red. The next ones, we go over the others fairly quickly. I did want to take the opportunity to read from Lewontin's book. It's just terrific, and again, you know, it's just the kind of supporting data we use in the quadrants where people are experts in it. The next one is selectivity of sources, not selected sources. He claims that Wilbur's statements are cherry-picked the variety even within the field of developmental psychology. Again, what that means is I went over this before in the previous one. He takes models, puts them up against each other, shows that they don't agree with each other, and therefore throws them all out. So developmental theory is a mess. It's nobody knows what's going on, yada, yada, yada. It's just categorical nonsense. Incidentally, I don't know any mainstream journal that accepted his papers. I know two journals that turned them down. I saw the reports on the ones from Journal of Humanistic Psychology, and they were uniformly negative. Mystical disagreement on mystical unity, the same old postmodernist stuff, that there's no commonalities, cross-cultural commonalities, and that can rather be dismissed. He talks about the fourfold view of mystical development, and of course that's when we're talking about nature mysticism and the deity mysticism, formless and non-dual, and at the time in the 70s, that's when we appeared that those were structure stages, and now we know they're state stages. So the one thing that I would change about that is that they're not necessarily developmental sequences, because you can peak experience, as we said. But if you look at the move from gross to subtle to causal, then they tend to be state stages. And, of course, I still stand by that. Do I expect a lot of agreement on that among religious theorists around the world? Not yet. But you take all the ones at Integral Spiritual Center, for example, and they agree. And those are, I think, the 25 finest contemplative spiritual teachers and philosophers in the world. But his main complaint still is that the cross-cultural stuff is taboo to somebody that can only see it, that's flying at green altitude. The next one is holarchic controversy, not holarchic consistency. And he says, we have had up until now holons within quadrants, holons that have quadrants, holons can be seen through quadrants. Anybody confused? And he says, reading room authors have pointed these inconsistencies for years. There are no inconsistencies. I went over this last time. A holon is, there are four different types. We describe the four types of holes and four different types of parts, and therefore you can use holons to refer to all or none of those. That takes care of that part of the inconsistency. in terms of holons having quadrants or being in quadrants. Both are true. Let me use the example in the upper right quadrant. They're atoms, molecules, cells. Each of those are holons. They're in the quadrant. They also possess quadrants. No inconsistency there whatsoever. If you take a little bit of goodwill to actually follow the definitions, instead of doing a hatchet job, you won't have trouble understanding simple little sentences like that. The last criticism, everybody is right except the critics. This applies conversely. If everyone is right, why exclude the critics? There's not a single critic whose position I haven't included some of their truths, and everybody knows that. When we look at any of the postmodern critics, the enormous amount of stuff I've included from that, even the Washburn critic, for example, tried to talk about the aspects of infancy in terms of access to subtle states that might be more fluid and so on. This is categorical nonsense. What we don't include are hatchet jobs. You don't integrate hatchet jobs. Those are just mysterious of negativities, and you toss those out. And then we get to chapter 12, which is a description of his own shadow, and I don't need to comment on that. But I just wanted to go on the record for that. I'm really sorry to have to waste people's time for this. It was basically over. Everybody had rejected his work until Visser brought it up again. Let me say normally that, again, what a lot of people over there don't know is all the discussions that we have over here and the hundreds of hours of stuff where we're all kind of discussing stuff and figuring out, you know, obviously I'm giving my particular take on something, but this is in the context of a whole series of discussions about what works, what doesn't work, and the thousands of hours of discussions we've had, you know, doing books and figuring out right terminology and how does this work and how does that work and so on, and all the enormous amount of stuff I've learned from people that have been applying this stuff. Every single time we, you know, I read one of these papers and we discuss it, even though I might be giving sort of, you know, the main teacher feedback, if you will, I learn a great deal every single time I do it, which is why I always look forward to this. So enough of that. Did anybody want to, anybody comments or anything? There's not too much to say.
Yeah, no, it was really fascinating to, you know, have you walk us through that book, The Triple Helix, you know, particularly for the work Zimmerman and I are doing with integral ecology. So I'm going to check that out and include some of that there.
Yeah, it's a good one. And again, it's really what sensitive biologists are doing. It's very simple. Where does variation come from?
Yeah.
It's just that simple. And you basically postulate either a supernatural source, of which there are two types. One is the platonic given, and one is basically the theological, a god or intelligent design. Or you postulate spirit as immanent. Of course, it's transcendent, but also immanent. And then it shows up as a self-organizing, self-transcending drive within evolution itself. And then evolution is spirit's own unfolding. Not in a supernatural, but an intranatural, an eminently natural aspect. And that's basically the position that I maintain. Of course, there's spirit prior to nature, prior to the Big Bang and so on, but it doesn't apply a force on nature from the outside, sort of kicking it around and sucking on it. Nature is spirit's form at any given moment as it unfolds. So spirit is within nature, not on top of nature or outside of nature. It's the interior components. And then, of course, spirit is ground. It's the ground of all of it, which is neither inside nor outside, nor both nor neither, and so on. But the idea that it's just some sort of, you know, dead telos, it's absolutely silly. You know, usually I treat critics with a little more respect, but hatchet jobs are just hatchet jobs. He's not here to try to point out the good aspects and the bad aspects and try to reach some, you know, balanced assessment. It's just a scorched earth policy. And many people pointed out that when he actually gets around his own recommendations, it's a watered-down version of integral life practice.
Yeah.
A really, really tepid version of integral life practice.
And, I mean, my main complaint about the book is that he doesn't make chapter 12 chapter 1 so that everyone's much clearer on where he's coming from.
Yeah, I know. Look, and you can make things sound, like, say, if you can take developmental psychology, put the models up against each other, take a selective quote saying, we don't know what's going on, and it makes you sound like, gosh, there's no development at all. I mean, you can do that, and he's got a wonderful way of kind of, you know, at least calming himself down enough to actually write some sort of, you know, sober sentences, and it sounds like they make sense. If you actually get back and look at the sources, see what he's doing, see what alternatives he proposes, and then you actually get a pretty clear picture of what's happening, and then it's just really sealed when you see chapter 12, and yeah, it should be chapter 1, but it pretty much gave the show away. I don't know if he'll ever realize that, but... I think if he writes another book, we'll find out.